Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brook and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Hi, I'm Debbie Brook, founder of Homeopathy World Community. I'll be speaking with our regular co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law, about some major issues going on in vaccination rights and exemptions in specifically the state of Colorado. Today is July 28, 2011. Thank you to all of our listeners and friends, for those who tweet and retweet, who share on Facebook these shows and get the word out about and create awareness about vaccinations and their effects and how you can put into effect your rights in these arenas. We appreciate when you comment and when you get onto the live chat, you can share this station with your friends via Facebook also, where we've posted it on the Homeopathy World Community Facebook fan page. There are a lot of convenient buttons, share buttons, right on the Blog Talk Radio website. So today, I'm going to start off with a quote of inspiration that is by Johann Caspar Lavater, who lived in 1741 to 1801. He was a Swiss writer, philosopher, and theologian. Quote, it says, "It is one of my favorite thoughts that God manifests himself to mankind in all wise, good, humble, generous, great, and magnanimous men." And I'm going to be introducing Alan, who I really admire. Maybe he fits the bill for that. Alan, I hope you're able to hear my intro.
I am, Debbie, and I'm delighted to be with you as always.
Great. We're going to continue on and tell people to post their comments and questions in the live chat on the Blog Talk Radio website. A little bit further introduction for those who are new to the show. Alan, we're so pleased that you're with us as the attorney from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and that you are a leading vaccine rights attorney. You advise individuals, families, other attorneys who need some advice, groups, organizations throughout the United States about exemption and waiver rights. And you are at the forefront of legislative initiatives aimed at expanding vaccine freedom of choice. You continue to publish internationally, and you are traveling to rallies, conferences, and I've been listening to you lately on other radio shows, too, and hearing the message that you're getting and the way that other people do the interview with you. You're on so many boards, I don't know how you keep up with it all, but I expect that you will tell us a little bit about how we can get legislatively active on some of those initiatives. I also want to remind people that you have a fabulous ebook that has become quite popular. It provides information to many people about their situation regarding informed decisions and learning a little bit about the legal issues. And then when they really have specific questions, they give you a call and get personal advice because actually everybody really needs to tailor their exemption specifically to their situation. Okay, we're going to be talking today. Oh, I have one other announcement for those people who are interested in homeopathy. because our very own Mary Aspinwall is going to be on the Natural News Talk Hour this evening, Thursday evening at 6 p.m. Pacific Time, or that's 9 p.m. Eastern Time in the United States. The registration is free, so you just have to log on to naturalnews.com and put in Google the Homeopathy Natural Remedies, or it's probably on this week's newsletter. And I'm looking forward to learning a little bit about what Mary has to tell the general public. Okay, so we are going to go ahead and talk about the issue today, which regards the Colorado Board of Health notes and what they are trying to do legislatively in their state.
Well, Debbie, as you know, of course, the vaccine legislation is an issue that crops up on a regular basis around the country. And I wish it were only about, in terms of my work in that arena, supporting initiatives seeking to expand informed choice or the right to choose or refuse vaccines. Unfortunately, we're in recent times have increasingly been put on kind of a defensive position where we see aggressive attempts to legislate in ways that both expand the use and distribution of vaccines. As we talked about recently, a couple of states at least have laws allowing minors to consent to vaccines without their parents knowing. And then we've had other states around the country seeking to restrict access to exemptions, all, of course, based on the mainstream party line view that vaccines are safe and effective and necessary, and that people who refuse vaccines are endangering themselves and everyone else. There is substantial evidence, scientific and otherwise, supporting a contrary view, of course, as we discuss repeatedly on this show, and will, I'm sure, continue to do so. But today I wanted to focus, as you said, on what's going on in Colorado, which just recently brought to my attention that the Colorado Board of Health, the Immunization Work Group, they had a session back in mid-May where they were proposing to develop required forms for vaccine exemptions. And there are a number of things that raise concerns about this, but they have and propose to continue having all three of the basic exemption types, personal, medical, and religious. And since, generally speaking, when people exercise a philosophical or personal exemption, there's no justification needed. You write a statement or sign a form or something to that effect. And medical exemptions involve having a medical doctor make the medical recommendation that somebody not be vaccinated for medical reasons. So the particular exemption of the few different types that the majority of my work concerns then is the religious exemption, because those are ones that, at least in some instances, have to be justified in terms of people writing their beliefs. Now, just a real quick note here, Debbie, that vaccine exemptions and waivers, the question of how to legally avoid vaccines comes up in, depending on how you count, but over a dozen different specific areas. And most people, when they hear the topic of exemptions, the first thing we think of is schools, and that is probably the place where it comes up the most often. But there are many different other arenas, including the military and immigration and healthcare employees and the like. Many school exemptions don't require you to state what your religious beliefs are. Many states have maybe forms where you sign a statement or check a box or something fairly straightforward. But in many instances, you do have to discuss your beliefs. And so in the ones where you have to discuss your beliefs, because there are some potential legal pitfalls there, that is, there are things that people would very reasonably think should qualify that it turns out for legal technicalities may not qualify. That's an area where people should look for more information to make sure that they have the strongest statement possible. And by strongest, I mean least vulnerable or least susceptible to a challenge over some kind of legal technicality. But what Colorado has done in drafting forms for all three these different kinds of exemptions, I'd like to talk about the religious form first.
They have actually drafted three different forms for each
they
type?
They have a different, that's correct, a different form for each kind of exemption.
Okay.
Now, they are proposing a meeting in the fall, at which point, presumably, if this goes forward, then this would subsequently become the law and procedure in Colorado. So this is something that is in the draft stage only, or the proposed stage, proposed by the Department of Health there. And so we have an opportunity, but in particular, when I say that in this instance, the citizens of Colorado, to raise questions and concerns and issues about this proposed procedure that they would be adding, I believe, as regulations, regulatory requirements within the Department of Health. But this is something that is not, I can't stress this enough, this is not something that is uniquely and solely a Colorado issue. The kinds of things that they are looking to do here in Colorado, and we'll go into a little more detail about that shortly, are things that have gone or are going on. New Jersey in recent months tried to restrict religious exemptions there. I believe they were unsuccessful. Washington State just successfully passed legislation that the governor signed that restricts access to exemptions in a manner that I personally believe is unconstitutional. And I had some wonderful informal and indirect feedback from a law professor, New York University law professor, who felt that I made some really good points in my assessment of the Washington law. So I was, you know, a lot of times...
Is that still up for debate? That is put into law now in Washington State. You posted a white paper about that?
Mm-hmm. There was a last-minute plea to the governor's office arguing, among other things, that this is unconstitutional for the reasons that I had set out in writing, and ultimately the governor rejected that. This is one of those situations where I find the response to be some disingenuous, but it's legally, they had a technicality that they could argue that gave them the ability to rationalize, in at least on the analytical level, a legitimate reason for saying that they're not going to be concerned themselves with the constitutionality of it. And it boils down to this, that...
How can they say that? Won't be concerned with the constitutionality? Yeah, that's what our laws are based upon.
Right. But here's the technicality, and it's a very important one.
Okay.
And that is that a law is not formally or technically unconstitutional unless a court rules on it. Because for every person who can say, well, that's unconstitutional, you'll find someone else who will say, no, it's not, it's fine. And the bottom line is, if all we had to do was say something is unconstitutional to avoid being subject to the law, then nobody would ever be subject to any law they didn't want to be subject to at any time. And, of course, that would be chaos. So it's an important and appropriate technicality, but it has a really huge downside. And the huge downside is that state legislatures can pass any law they want to, whether it's ultimately constitutional or not. And so that puts the onus on us as the citizens to, first of all, be informed about what laws are pending in our state. And when a law that appears to be unconstitutional is up for consideration, we need to make our voices heard and make the most persuasive legal argument that we can if we feel it is unconstitutional and convince the legislators not to pass it. Now, if they pass a law that we believe is unconstitutional, then the available step for us is to challenge that law formally in court and make the best argument there we can, and of course hope that the court agrees with us and rules that it's unconstitutional.
In those cases, Alan, I mean, if they've gone ahead and passed the law, then do you actually have to have a situation where somebody is going to put themselves on the line? Is that correct? Because
Well, you have to file a lawsuit, you have to have standing. And the specifics for what constitutes standing, there are constitutional federal constitutional boundaries for that. The details could potentially vary from state to state as it pertains to state law. But you can't sue over a hypothetical future injury. There has to be, as a general rule, there are exceptions everywhere, but as a general rule, there has to be someone who is suffered harm or at imminent risk of suffering harm in order to have standing to be able to sue. So if I think that somebody else is harmed or going to be harmed by a current situation, I can't go sue. Only the person who has standing is the person who is suffering the harm or at risk of suffering harm. But
the reason I ask that is because I want to make it perfectly clear and emphasize the fact that citizens must do something before the fact, before something is signed. That's the point that I would like to make, that we need to be aware.
Mm-hmm. As much as possible, because there appear not to be, and I'll phrase it like this because I don't know what sort of checks and balances there may or may not be with specificity in any given state legislature, but there appear to be either no real built-in filters to assess the constitutionality of laws and reject them if they're bills and reject them outright if they're unconstitutional, or there appear to be very lax rules because there can be different opinions about whether something is constitutional. I mean, lawyers make a living mm-hmm. out of creating the best argument they can to support their client's point of view, whether it's ultimately a winning point of view or not. Sometimes they are hired guns to do the best they can, and whatever happens, happens, to one degree or another anyway. But other times, there really are genuine opposing viewpoints, and you really do need a court to weigh it all out and decide. But in any case, the recourse now for the folks in Washington State is to challenge this law in court, and I certainly hope that somebody will. I think they have a very strong case, and there will be problems with the law. But this is the sort of thing now that we're seeing more and more of, and I think we should and mm-hmm. can expect to see increasingly more of these kind of movements to put us on the defensive. And even if we ultimately win, we're going to spend a lot of time and energy and effort doing that, which ultimately, or maybe the word would be hypothetically or strategically, would be better spent in a more proactive stance.
Maybe the people should who are listening now, who have not been listening over the course of the last months, should understand that if something is passed in one state, it puts a precedent before the law that other states can piggyback upon that. One short thing about that.
Yeah, not precedent in a formal legal sense, but it certainly creates some inertia, so to speak, some momentum, some basis to encourage other states. Oh, they did it there and it worked, so
right.
we can do it here.
They can cite it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's so that's very disturbing to me, because we made the argument in Washington. I'm not sure whether the constitutional argument got out to state legislators, but it certainly got to the governor's office, and we got their attention with it. It just didn't, in the end, it just wasn't persuasive. And because if the governor's agenda is pro-vaccine, the governor can ultimately say, and the state legislators can say, so sue me. And I see this in with individual clients. Fortunately, it's a minority of the time, but occasionally I'll have a client who has a clear right, in my opinion, and the institution involved will say, of course they don't use these words, but they reject, what I think is a sound, solid legal argument, and in effect saying, so sue me. In other mm-hmm. words, you think you have a right? Take me to court and prove it. And they are in the position to do that. It's unfortunate, but it's a necessary consequence of the larger framework for things to be fair. The framework has to be such, and this is sort of a downside of it, that it enables people to, on the other side of this issue, to put a burden on us that ultimately is unfortunate because it really, we'll just say we have our work cut out for us. We had it cut out anyway, but even more so now. But let's dive into the specifics here, because the Colorado Religious Exemption Form, this proposed form, has a rather focused and specific concern in terms of the constitutionality. First of all, they have a list of the required vaccines and then a secondary list of recommended vaccines, and they want the person using this form to initial every single one of those vaccines. In other words, if you're going to refuse vaccines for religious reasons, we want you to know every gosh darn vaccine that you are refusing.
Oh, really?
Okay, so...
You must click every single, and there's how many, does that mean the boosters too? You know, like there's 60 of them or something.
Well, on the religious form, they don't delineate across time. You know, are you refusing the vaccines at 2 months and at 4 months and at 6 months and at 18 months and whatever the, you know, vaccination times are. Interestingly, they do that for the medical, and that's not at all inconsistent with medical exemption rights generally, as I understand it, that, for example, medical exemptions can sometimes be for only one or some vaccines that a doctor thinks are problematic, but other vaccines may be okay, depending on what the specific medical condition is, you know, that is the basis for a medical exemption. But on the Colorado proposed medical exemption form, they have check these for 4 months, for 6 months, for 12 to 15 months, for 4 years, 11 to 12 years. The doctor can, you know, check the form. In other words, medical exemptions can be temporary.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what I see as sort of a general concept across the board with medical exemptions, that you can be medically exempt if you have the qualifying condition, or a qualifying condition, but only for as long as that condition persists. So as soon as, you know, the vaccine is no longer a threat for you, then of course you should be vaccinated under the mainstream view of vaccines. So this is what we see, you know, with health exemptions generally. Religious exemptions tend to contemplate an all or nothing point of view. I mean, if you have religious beliefs opposed to vaccines, you don't want the vaccines. And unless you have some sort of shift in your religious beliefs at some hypothetical and perhaps ultimately arbitrary future point, you know, you shouldn't have to be repeatedly exercising a religious exemption. Having said that, there's at least one state, and I wouldn't be surprised if many, that either have or have proposed having a rule that you have to exercise the exemption for your kids in school every year. I am happy to say that I exercised the exemption here in North Carolina for my kids when I first enrolled them in school, and the issue has never come up again. That could change, of course, at any time. What's happened is that exemptions on the whole are on the rise around the country. And as, of course, anybody familiar with this show or similar information from other sources knows, there's darn good reasons for that. The problem, of course, is that is making people who have a mainstream view of vaccines very nervous, because as the exemption rates increase, they believe that the exempt people and other kids are creating a health risk or a health hazard. Because everybody knows that when your unvaccinated child gets around vaccinated children, it mysteriously and magically causes all those vaccinations not to work, and they're all going to get sick. So, you know, these unvaccinated kids pose a horrible, you know, risk to everybody else.
Right.
But that's the mentality. Obviously, I'm being, you know, extremely sarcastic or whatever you want to call it there. But that's the mentality out there. It's
bringing
a fear-based
up a
mentality.
Point. Yeah, you're bringing up a good point, and it is questionable. And we'll do another show on herd immunity theory.
Yes.
And I will call it a theory. But still, we are seeing a big push by those in authority for getting everyone vaccinated, because they're seeing such an increase in people who are questioning that view, which has been around for so long.
But we're also seeing, or at least we're seeing reported, you know, various outbreaks around the country, and that triggers the fear issue as well. And so there's fear on both or all sides of this issue, and that drives a lot of people on both or all sides. I say all because there's some middle ground views as well, between the all or nothing with vaccines. But there's a lot of fear mixed in, and that's a really difficult thing to keep control of, to keep, if anything should be suppressed, it would be the fear, to the extent that it tends to at times override a rational approach to the issue and the question. Of course, fear is also a powerful manipulator, and so I don't think there's a whole lot of attempt on the part of health authorities to approach this in a rational and transparent way. Quite the opposite. They tend to sensationalize and exaggerate and sometimes mislead or even deliberately deceive and with regard to actual facts and issues, apparently or appearing to be many times with the deliberate intent to stimulate fear, because that will drive people who maybe were on the fence, for example, or had been lax in getting around immunizing to rush out there and do it. But I tell you, if you're going to look at fear to the extent that it's a valid part of this debate, and it is, there are really good reasons to be afraid of the vaccines. So, but let me reel myself in here, because the point.
Can you tell us what does it say exactly in the proposed requirement? Is there something you can read?
Yes. And I mean, this is, again, it's a very simple and specific point on the proposed Colorado religious exemption form. So after it gives you the list of required and recommended vaccines and asks you to sign off with your initials on each and every one of those, and why would you need to sign off on recommended vaccines? Because they're not required. But they have them on the list here. Then they have a place here for religious leader signature. And this is what is so disturbing to me, disturbing for two reasons. First of all, there's a long line of federal legal precedent that says that you do not have to belong to an organized religion. It doesn't matter which one you belong to. If you do, you can be Buddhist, Catholic, Taoist, Methodist, Baptist, Jewish, Islamic, or have no affiliation with any church. If your personal interpretation of your religion, or if you're not affiliated with a religion, if your beliefs are religious in nature and they're sincerely held, you qualify for a vaccine religious exemption. But there are some technicalities here that complicate this, and that's what distresses me even more, because it opens a door for someone like the state of Colorado or the health department there or other states to rationalize in the same way that the Washington State Governor's Office rationalize that, oh, well, you know, it's not really unconstitutional because it hasn't been decided in courts in our jurisdiction in this particular instance, but it's a very similar sort of thing. So we can make the case, and I'm happy to make that today in brief or at length, whatever, you know, seems appropriate for today's show with you and with you, Debbie. But the bottom line is there's legal precedent that says that that is an unconstitutional restriction. The problem is the precedent comes from other jurisdictions. New York federal district courts, the Second Circuit, which is up in New England, federal appellate court. The decisions from those courts are binding only on their own jurisdictions. So the courts and state in those jurisdictions has to follow those decisions, absolutely. As to the rest of the country, those cases are what's called persuasive precedent. Now, as a practical matter, it turns out that these cases are very persuasive because state courts around the country have been following this precedent. The problem is, as a legal technicality, the state of Colorado doesn't have to follow that precedent. So if what's really going on here is a pro-vaccine agenda no matter what, then it doesn't matter what we say to them. They're going to do what they want to do, and then it's going to be up to us to challenge it in court. But I think if we make enough, I don't mean to suggest at all that we shouldn't fight this. Quite the contrary, we may save ourselves a court battle in the future if we can successfully persuade them now. So it's sort of a caveat here. Yes, I can, and in fact, I was starting on this today. I'll have an article, hopefully, up with Natural News the next day or two, explaining this argument in detail in writing. And then, of course, anybody who wants to borrow from that or use that argument to talk with their local representatives in Colorado or with state, local and state health department people expressing your concerns about this. Let's do that. Now, they also have a form for personal exemption, and we can talk about how to address that, although that would not be on the grounds of a legal argument about constitutionality. That would be a more fact-based argument.
What would they be using? Yeah, go ahead.
Things like, and then I want to come back to the religious one, but things like, whereas I can say for the religious leader signature component to this form, if that's intended to be a requirement, it's clearly unconstitutional, and here are the federal court cases I can point to that say all those things I just said. Bottom line, doesn't matter whether or not you belong to an organized religion, nor does it matter which one you belong to. If you do, all you need is a sincerely held religious belief. So I can make that legal case in writing. It'll fit on a page. If you talk about the personal exemption where they want to have you sign off with a medical doctor, I don't have a legal argument as to why the state can't do that. I don't care for it. Unless there's some argument that would be connected to where you're telling people to exercise a legal right that they have to go spend money on a doctor or nurse and get counsel on vaccines before they can exercise the option, that really seems at least unfair. But as to whether it's really...
You're talking right now about the fact that for a medical exemption, we need to have a physician sign off that it is true.
No, because that sort of, by definition, a medical exemption would necessarily require a medical expert to recommend it. I'm talking about the personal or philosophical exemption. Under this proposed Colorado Department of Health, their proposed form for personal, or they call it a personal, but sometimes referred to as philosophical exemption, you have to go get a physician or a nurse to sign off on the form. And they sign off on it after they tell you what a horrible person you are for not vaccinating. Here's all the risk you're causing yourself and other people. And don't you really want to get these vaccines? Well, you're not going to hear from the vast majority of physicians and nurses, you're not going to hear an objective, unbiased view. And really, the state, you should either give you the right or not. You know, you don't hand somebody something and then as soon as they take it, slap them on the wrist for taking it.
I'm confused. Why would, if you're getting a personal or philosophical exemption, why do you need a physician or nurse? What do they have to do with your personal belief system?
The state wants you to have every opportunity to be talked out of exercising the right. They're concerned about disease outbreak and so forth. They want to make sure that exemptions are kept down to a minimum. So they want to put in every lawful and apparently unlawful restriction that they can get away with
right.
into place to minimize the exemptions to presumably protect the community. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't make sense. No, unless you look at it from the point of view of, okay, you can have this exemption right, but not really.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can have it, but we're not sure if you really can have it or not. We really want to, you can have
well,
it, but, you know, you have to work for it.
It seems that it is all one-sided, that if you have a person who has a personal and philosophical exemption and that they're required to get signed off by a physician or nurse, they should go to a person who is a statistician on the history of vaccines and communicable diseases and find out about that. And then they should go and get a signature from somebody who is a philosopher and to make sure that somebody understands what philosophy is. And, you know, it doesn't make any sense because it's totally unbiased to do. It's totally biased to have only one side of the issue.
As long as you consider, because the state is really talking out of both sides of its head with this, in any state, with this kind of approach. You know, it's again, they're saying you can have the exemption, but not really, but maybe you can, but I'm not sure. Wait, you can have it. No, don't. Well, okay, but you have to do. I mean, it's just.
They're handing you. I'm seeing a picture of somebody handing a kid a cookie and then pulling back and not giving it to them You know?
Well, it's not that they don't give it to them, though. It's like when the kid takes the cookie, the kid says, thank you, reaches out, and as soon as the kid grabs the cookie, they slap him on the wrist for grabbing it. It's like, you can have it, but you're going to get punished for having it. It's really what they're saying here. We want to make sure, if you exercise a philosophical exemption in Colorado, that you know that you're being a bad person for doing that. Well,
right.
let's back up here. Either give me the exemption or not. But the point is the alleged motivation, and probably true motivation from the people on the front lines, is that they think they're doing something that's for the benefit of the community. They're basing it on experts that historically we have always relied on as the experts for health generally, and that is medical doctors and the allopathic community. The problem, of course, as we know, is that the pharmaceutical industry, well documented to have corruption throughout its ranks, so to speak, and has infiltrated state and federal agencies and drives and dictates policy and law not based on health and maximizing health, but based on maximizing profit, many times at the expense of health and even life. And so we have this dysfunctional system that pretends to be functional, gives the correct outward appearance, just like dysfunctional individuals do, but ultimately doesn't stand up to scrutiny. The problem is that the way the system is designed is that there's very little room for that key stand-up-to-scrutiny component. We are the scrutiny. We, the citizens, we, the public, we, the individuals who educate ourselves on these issues, we are that scrutiny. It's not going to fix itself. We have to get involved. We have to speak out. We have to speak up. We have to keep going forward even when we're not heard or we're not listened to. And a lot of the time we're going to be dismissed or not listened to, called crazy, called baby killers and the like. You know, that has happened. It's going to keep happening. We need to have a thick skin, let that roll off, and keep going. Because we have been gaining momentum despite the enormous efforts to the contrary.
So we're, it's like, you know, there's this problem in the schools of bullying. And in reality, what you're talking about is the people, adults, people who have developed their own rational, logical system of thinking are being bullied into trying to do something they don't want to do or think have a system of belief that is not their their inner guide is not telling them to believe that. So it's pervasive in many walks of life. So what are we going to talk about here regarding this Colorado Board of Health issue? What can be done on our part, and is there any other parts of this that we should know about?
Well, this, let me see what this document was called. There's a document posted online. It's a Colorado Immunization Program meeting agenda notes, at the end of which has these sample forms. I'll link to that in the article that, again, I hope to have up with Natural News in the next couple of days.
Let me see if I find it. Yeah. Did you? Well, go ahead. I'm going to look for it while you're talking.
Sure. If you type in Colorado draft exemption form, you'll pull it right up.
The meeting notes?
Yes.
Then
if you scroll down, you'll see the sample. So they say the next step is that what's called a request for hearing will be processed to bring these immunization proposals before the Colorado Board of Health sometime this fall. Then they'll have plans made to provide draft exemption forms, they say, to several groups for review and update. And I have no idea what that really refers to. But we need to be following this process, and especially people in Colorado, maybe even contacting the Board of Health and say, you know, when and where can I provide input about these forms? And ultimately, what you're really trying to do is make a persuasive argument. Even what to me is kind of a no-brainer legal argument about the idea of having a religious official sign a form, that really needs to go out the window because it's blatantly unconstitutional. But even that is ultimately a persuasive argument, hopefully very persuasive, because as I said before, technically this law, or this, in this case it would be a regulatory requirement, It's not going to be technically unconstitutional if they decide to go forward with it and use it, unless a court says so. But, you know, what in effect you're really saying then with the persuasive legal argument is, here's why you don't want to use this form, because it's going to lose later in court if you go with it now. So let's go ahead and fix it now and save everybody the trouble. Depending on their, you know, disposition and their position on the issue, they would either hear that and do the common sense response, which is to modify the form so that that requirement isn't in there.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that.
What would be the end result
if they just remove that one signature line from the religious leader? Then it's still in place.
I don't see a problem with the state. I don't see legally a problem with the state having a form that a parent has to sign in order to exercise a religious exemption. Now, there may be, you know, others who would disagree with that, but I don't see that as a legal problem. What I see as a problem is bringing things into that form that would raise significant constitutional questions, such as a requirement that somebody be a member of an organized religion.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not a problem. I'm not sure whether or not there's a legal problem with a philosophical or personal exemption form that requires you to have a doctor sign off. That bothers me, but I'm not sure if the reasons are more kind of moral, ethical, and common sense than actually a technical legal requirement. But I do think, at minimum, it raises a serious ethical issue where the state is essentially talking out of both sides of its mouth there, that, you know, you either have the exemption right or you don't. You don't give the right and then tell somebody they're bad for doing it. You know, the form makes reference, as many exemption forms I've seen in other places do, about how the failure to... Now, here it's interesting. They say on the form, failure to follow the advice of the physician, nurse, PA, or public health official, as opposed to saying failure to get the vaccines. But they're, you know, it's not literally every physician, nurse, et cetera, is going to say get vaccinated, but the overwhelming majority, vast majority of them will. In any case, failure to follow that advice may endanger the health or life of my child and others who come in contact with my child. Well, if there were a significant risk, the state legislature wouldn't have given us the option in the first place. So get your act together, state. Either give us the exemption or not. If you're going to give it to us, give it to us. Don't give it to us and then slap us on the wrist, you know, or worse, for exercising it. So there's really, at minimum, there's an ethical issue there. And the idea that to exercise the right requires someone to, bottom line, spend money getting a physician or nurse or other appropriate official to sign the form after they've spent their time, which they're not going to do for free, giving you a lecture about what an awful person you are, here are all the things that can happen.
Right, so they make you jump through a lot of hurdles to get the end result.
And the rationale for it, at least the surface one that is offered, as opposed to the deeper one, which has to do with profit and control and so forth, is this mainstream view of vaccines that mainstream sources contradict. And so we are dealing with a false paradigm, and of course, and efforts being made by those of us who are aware of the legitimate reasons to question vaccines, to bring transparency to the issue and ultimately policies and laws that reflect the whole story.
Did you have something to say about the 14th Amendment? Is this in regard to this or the Bill of Rights or anything else?
Sure. And this is thanks for reminding me of that. And this is part of the complication here. When a state enacts a religious exemption law, federal First Amendment rights and possibly other constitutional rights automatically attach to that. And it works like this. Originally, the U.S. Constitution only applied to the federal government. But a series of Supreme Court cases over a period of many decades of time, running right on into the early and mid-1900s, if not beyond, gradually applied what's called the doctrine of incorporation. And what that means in this instance, it has to do with the fact that portions of the federal Constitution, and in particular, the majority of the Bill of Rights, which is the first 10 amendments, have been deemed to apply to state and local governments. If it were not for the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, we wouldn't have any federal constitutional right to religious freedom. But we do because of the Due Process Clause and the way the Supreme Court has interpreted that over the years. The portion of the First Amendment that's called the Free Exercise Clause, and it refers to the free exercise of religion, that right, among many other what are sometimes referred to collectively as fundamental rights, these fundamental rights apply to state and local governments too. So a state cannot enact a religious exemption without then that religious exemption being drafted and construed or applied within the boundaries of the Constitution, the First Amendment. So it necessarily complicates the law in the sense that even a state religious exemption law has both state and federal rights. But that complication is ultimately a good one because federal law is generally a higher level of authority than state law. So if there's any clash between state and federal law, unless there's some applicable exception, federal law is going to supersede state law or trump state law. So, for example, there have been about 5 different states around the country where they had one version or another of a vaccine religious exemption law that required membership in an organized religion. And at least 5 times, those kinds of laws have been challenged in state or federal court. And every time, they've been held to be unconstitutional. But again, if it hasn't been challenged in Colorado, and Colorado is not one of the states where they've had a law like that that's been challenged, then technically speaking, those decisions in other states or other jurisdictions aren't binding on Colorado. And so the state and the health department has the option if they choose to, and I personally think it would be a very disingenuous choice, but they can choose to say, well, we don't know if that's unconstitutional here in Colorado, so we're going to go ahead and enact this law or go ahead and use this draft of the form, and if somebody wants to challenge it in court, then we can find out if it's unconstitutional here in Colorado.
So what needs to be done? Because, I can't imagine that it would not hold up in court that to have this signature from a religious organized leader would apply constitutionally. Therefore, what do we need to do? How can we get the word out or organize ourselves so that the persons in charge in Colorado get the message that you've got to change that?
And that's really, where does the rubber meet the road here? What do we do about this? And that's the pertinent question here. First of all, let me just clarify again that we're not talking about proposed legislation. We're talking about something that's happening within the Department of Health itself, which would be on a regulatory level. So I don't know, for example, off the top of my head, what Colorado's exemption laws say, but I will presume for the moment, unless I look at it later and discover otherwise, that what the health department is proposing is something that falls within the boundaries of the statutes, because agencies, when they, and the technical word for this is promulgate, which means to make or enact, when they promulgate regulations, they have to do that within the boundaries of the authority that's been delegated to them by the state legislature. So they can't, for example, have requirements in their forms or regulations if it goes outside of the boundary of the wording of their own state law. So that's something we need to take a look at, and I'll take a look at. But the two things, in the simplest way, the two things that need to happen is we need to find out when and where the public has input, and we need to provide the best input we can. I'm mm-hmm. going to do my part to help the citizens of Colorado with that to the best of my ability, and I believe I will be able to do that in a way that will be very helpful. There will be people who will, you know, like and agree with much of what I say and offer in terms of an article. There will be others who will have other things that they want to say or other reasons they want to add to it, what have you, and that's all fine. Again, I don't mean to tell anybody what to say. All I mean to say is here are some things that I think are important that will help. And this will be in two basic sections or categories or arenas, whatever you want to call it. The first will be addressing this narrow point in the religious exemption form about this what appears to be a requirement, because it doesn't say optional, religious leader signature. And second of all, and frankly, the idea that they just list all the vaccines and you have to check off each one individually, they really should have a line there that says all vaccines, either just that or at least add that. And it raises a separate question. I'll be real brief on this if I can, Debbie, but people occasionally ask me, well, can you refuse some vaccines on religious grounds? And the answer technically to that is it's probably not clear unless you have a statute that comes right out and says you can refuse any vaccines that you're religiously opposed to. And I've only seen that once. Years ago, the Washington state exemption law was kind of a pick-or-choose law, which was really interesting. They no longer have a law like that. But there's probably not an exemption law, religious exemption law anywhere that is written in a way where it clearly, explicitly gives you the option to do some as opposed to all or none. I think religious exemption statutes contemplate all or nothing. But I also think there's an interesting potential argument. I just haven't seen a legal precedent case on this point yet. But I think it would be a legitimate position if somebody said they're only opposed to those vaccines for religious reasons, only those vaccines whose development involved the use of aborted fetal tissue. And I learned recently from an article at Mercola.com that there are as many as 24 different vaccines whose development involved the use of aborted fetal tissue. So people who are concerned about that issue, it's right. Probably bigger than most of us realize, even those of us who are aware of it. I had no idea there were that many vaccines. Now, when I say vaccines, I'm talking about individual manufactured vaccines. So it might be the same kind of vaccine from different companies. But in any case, you know, looking at all the different manufacturers, at least 24, I think, let's say I'll use North Carolina as an example, whose law clearly does not clearly allow for pick and choose with a religious exemption. I think if somebody made that case, they would probably have the exemption rejected. If you took it to court, you probably would lose at the trial court level. You get up to the appellate level, I think you have an argument that the appellate court would seriously consider. How they would come out with it, who knows. But potentially, if a legislature didn't write that into the law, potentially an appellate court could carve out an interpretation of the law that would say, you know, that that's a legitimate exercise of religious exemption. But I think today, for the most part, religious exemption laws really have an all or nothing approach. So why are they listing all the individual vaccines? Is that really just a trap so they can say, oh, you're not opposed to all of them, therefore you can't have the exemption? Or is it just because they want you to say no to everyone so that you know what a horrible, terrible person you are because of the risk for every one of these diseases you're taking for your child and putting other people at risk and so forth. Who knows the rationale? But legally, there's no need whatsoever to list all the vaccines on a religious exemption form. You're either opposed to them for religious reasons or you're not.
Okay, so you had two sections. You said addressing
the
narrow court of religious exemption form for the religious leader signature. And then you had another one that was not the listing of all the vaccines?
No, my two categories here were one concerning the religious exemption form and the other concerning the personal exemption form. The point is that the main issue with the religious exemption form is a constitutional issue. You can't require a religious leader to sign a form.
Right.
The point with the personal and there are other lesser issues with religious exemption, as I was just talking about. But with the personal exemption, I'm from a unless they are saying you can, for personal reasons, refuse some but not all vaccines, they shouldn't be listing all the vaccines. Again, I think the reason they're doing that is just because they do it on both of these forms.
Okay.
I think the reason they're doing that is just because they want you to know how bad a person you are. They want to talk you out of it, bottom line.
Right.
So I think that's why they're doing it. But really, if you're going to exercise it, you're going to exercise it. The issues there, though, I think have more to do with facts than law. And this would be facts about the misinformation and misunderstanding about vaccines, about the corruption and conflicts of interest in the industry and in the agencies such as the CDC, who the state health departments rely on. You know, your proposed draft form assumes blah, blah, blah. Well, what it assumes is not always correct, and the sources it relies on are sometimes corrupt, and not just as a matter of personal opinion, but a matter of documentation. For example, as we mentioned previously, Paul Thorson, the guy who headed up the research for the CDC, that the CDC has pointed to for years, saying that vaccines don't cause autism, and here's the proof. Well, he was just indicted on 13 counts of fraud with the CDC, so that all goes out the window. If you're going to rely on a fraudulent agency, you know, that's fine, but don't impose that on us, the citizens, because we want to have options that are based on credible sources and credible information. And the source you rely on is full of corruption, documented.
Okay,
corruption.
So, but I want to get back to the issue of the actions that public citizen can take. And you said that you're going to be posting on Natural News a new article that delineates all of this information. And is it safe for us to copy and paste that into our own blogs and write our own editorial opinions with that? Should we all be going to our local newspapers and writing some sort of a letter to the editor? Should we be doing press releases? Tell us what we can do so that we get this message out, that this is going to be, you know, it seems like they're trying every angle to change the law, not just by the top down, by federal and state, but getting into the actual regulatory commissions within each state.
Well, in one level, it's very simple. And then let's expand on that a little bit, Debbie, because you made a lot of good suggestions there. And this is something that we could take a few minutes to explore here and perhaps should. But on the kind of the first layer, if you will, the question is, when and where does the public have input on this regulatory process or the agency process? And I don't have a clear answer to that, but the step would be to contact the Colorado Department of Health and say, with regard to this May 18th memo or whatever they call it here, and draft exemption forms, you know, as a citizen, I have concerns about this that I'd like to share. Please tell me when and where and how to do that. So we'll get that information out. I'll bet you if it's not already on the NVIC's advocacy portal that it will be soon. And so folks can go to NVIC.org, that stands for National Vaccine Information Center. go to NVIC, V as in Victor, IC.org, and look for the link for the advocacy portal. And go sign up for the advocacy portal. It doesn't cost you anything to sign up, and it's a way to keep track of what's going on legislatively in each state. While this is not specifically a legislative issue, although we certainly could be taking our concerns about this to the state legislature, state representatives to that level, right now at this point, the process that's going on is not a legislative one. It's an agency process, the Board of Health or Department of Health. So there will, I'm sure, be some kind of process or means within that process for the public to provide input. We just need to determine what that is. And then, of course, the second step is to provide the input. Now, the more people who are providing input, who are raising concerns, the more persuasive power we're going to have. If one person goes in there with a great argument, but it's only one person, it's really easy to just write that off. Well, most people don't really care about this, so why should we bother? So the ideal strategic point of view is to have the most convincing legal and factual, you know, documented arguments, but to also have the greatest number of people you can get making them. So the second part is the one that I have a less clear answer and think it's one we should explore, perhaps on an ongoing level. But I think all the things you mentioned, Debbie, are certainly possibilities. Anybody could, and as far as I'm concerned, anybody who wants to take my article or any part of it and share it with local newspapers or radios or any other kind of outlet, I can guarantee as soon as the alternative vaccine community catches wind of this, that it'll get spread around the Facebook pages and Yahoo groups and so forth, which
well,
is fine.
Well, people can take this show today and post the widget on their own website so that people can sit back and listen to this discussion and make decisions for themselves as to how what they believe and how they think about this issue. I mean, not everybody's going to be there for an exemption. And I think it should be both sides. Everybody needs to know what's going on in their local community. You know?
Right. And this, I want to stress again, Debbie, this is not a Colorado-specific issue. I mean, it is in that we're talking about specifically what's going on in Colorado, but this is something that we've already seen happen in one manner or another in other states, and it's going to be happening in more states. I don't mean to sound paranoid, but I think that's we have to assume that's the case, and that's the pattern up to this point. This is just a further step in an ongoing pattern that's already involved at least three or four other states. They're not going to stop here, and if the buck doesn't stop here with us, it's just going to keep on rolling. So we are in a defensive posture necessarily. I would love to have a show in the future where we talk about how we organize a offensive strategy, because we really need, if we're going to make headway in any significant or meaningful way in any reasonably short-term period of time on this issue, we're going to have to organize and work collectively in the states together. And we need to be spending now. We need to be having, creating and having the conversation about how do we organize to have not just in individual states, but even with state law issues, with people who are dealing with the same or similar issues in other states. How do we turn this into an offensive
right.
campaign and strategy and not just the random sort of defensive thing that we're doing now?
Right. Instead of swatting at flies and things like that, what we need to be doing is educating the public about what is going on behind the scenes, because people really don't know. People have not read all the news, and it's just by word of mouth that someone says, you know, this is a concern of mine. Did you hear about what Rupert Murdoch and his involvement with the media and vaccines? And then I wanted to just bring up, if we have time, to talk about this other issue. Today it says, young people should not take flu vaccine, watchdog says. The European Medicine Agency said that Pandemrix, P-A-N-D-E-M-R-I-X, should only be given to the under 20s if they are at risk of contracting swine flu and alternative jabs are not available. So there are a lot of issues that people, it's not in their field of vision. And we need to let them know that, you know, not to just take it lightly, not to just say, oh, the school says I need to take this, or there's this campaign to get all of the boys and girls to get the Gardasil. And so if you don't mind, we could talk a little bit about what's going on with this Pandemrix.
Yeah, Pandemrix. Yeah, and I believe that has to do with, and I've seen a series of articles for many months now looking at different stages of the research and development, investigating problems with narcolepsy. There's a high percentage of children. I originally heard about this from Scandinavian countries, but it's now been documented in other countries. Children who got the swine flu vaccine developing narcolepsy, which can be debilitating. This is a disease where you, or condition, a neurological condition where you just sort of spontaneously fall asleep.
Right, and if you're driving, that would not be safe. You know,
yeah,
I'm,
well,
you wouldn't
be allowed to have a license, you know.
Well, you don't know until it's too late. So I'm just I wasn't very good at pronouncing the name of this drug, but it must have, some developer must have thought of the lice hair thing for nicks to get rid of something, and then the word pandemic. So it's pan. How do you pronounce it? Pandemic.
Well, Pandemrix is what I
Pandemrix.
Say, but I'm not the
okay.
authority on this.
I just don't where to accent the syllable on that one. But
well done.
Okay, so the Pandemrix, manufactured by the British pharmaceutical giant GlaxoSmithKline, was given to 30 million people across Europe after the outbreak of the swine flu. That was the H1N1 strain, and that was started in Mexico early in 2009, and it was approved by the European regulator in September that year. But the August and the safety was reviewed by the health officials in Finland and did claim that it had been linked to narcolepsy. And there was a lot of whispering about that and not really coming out clearly. But it seems that now it is definitely related. 335
well,
cases.
I've seen a lot of articles addressing one facet or another of this issue, but I think this most recent one that you mentioned is the strongest, that somebody would go so far as to say, well, kids really shouldn't get this vaccine, you know, unless they're such and such. And that's just very unusual. You know, I'm always surprised, if pleasantly surprised, when I see a mainstream source that I expect to be pro-vaccine to say something that gives any weight whatsoever to the other side of the issue, you know, to a concern about vaccines at all. And this is one that there's been evidence from several countries now supporting this narcolepsy connection. Of course, there are plenty of evidence supporting all kinds of other connections here in the U.S. that we still don't acknowledge here in the U.S. and perhaps in the world at large. But this is a toe in the door. You know, if only that.
Well, they give a figure. They say that for every 100,000 adolescents who get the injection, up to seven of those are likely to develop narcolepsy. So perhaps they would weigh the pros and the cons. Well, 7 out of 100,000, is that good? You know, or are we protecting so many? You know, many more of these young people, or are we risking their lives? I don't know.
You have to consider, though, when you're saying 7 out of 100,000, when you're talking about millions of people, it probably is cost-effective to go ahead and sell the vaccines and the treatment for narcolepsy. So if they've got a better disease that they can get in higher numbers, then they'll go for that, I'm sure. But, you know, in a pinch, they'll settle for narcolepsy. I'm being sarcastic, but this is narcolepsy is a lifelong condition. It's not something that I've ever heard of that somebody has temporarily and it goes away. Maybe that can be the case.
I don't think so.
There are neurological conditions that can be temporary, you know, it's certainly a possibility that people afflicted with this are going to be dealing with it for the rest of their lives. I mean, it may be that this is something that you don't just, you know, have as a temporary side effect. And
it's interesting that it's only in young people.
Well, and this is interesting, too, because my recollection is that the mainstream sources during the pandemic were saying that swine flu as a disease is most of a risk to
young
pregnant
people.
Women and to, well, they said younger people as opposed to seasonal flu, which was only, you know, infants and the elderly. But they said this swine flu was more of a risk to younger people. I don't remember them saying, I know I'd be wrong here. I don't remember them saying particularly, you know, teenagers or something like that. But it was, it seemed to affect obese people more. Of course, there was all the hype about pregnant women, which I, you know, never bought and still don't buy. But
I thought they said that I may be wrong, but I thought they said that supposedly healthy people were more likely to come down with it. You know, you think of a healthy athlete or someone.
I don't think they were saying they were more likely. I think what they were saying is, unlike the seasonal flu, which tends not to affect people in the prime of life, you know, people who are not infants and elderly.
The weakened and vulnerable would be more
right,
likely to get
right.
the seasonal flu.
But at this point, it's hard, you know, looking back on it, it's hard to know how much of that had any truth to it or not, because what has been clearly shown is that there was a lot of false information perpetrated or distributed, presented about it that we now know is not true. And I don't know about those pieces specifically, but I tell you, once you find a key thread and you pull on it, you know, there's a chance the whole fabric will unravel, and that's really what I would expect to happen if we really had a objective, transparent, thorough scientific investigation into swine flu.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of hype, and some of the pieces of it I have clarity on, and others I don't, and these are ones I don't, frankly.
Well, the reason that I had brought up that issue was the idea that people do not recognize, they have not been informed about the other side of the issue. They mostly hear, blasting over the radio or going to the supermarket or the drugstore. They see the signs that say, get your vaccine now, it's not too late, even when the influenza is here. And without regard for potential opposite sides and harmful effects. And by letting them know the other side of the story, they can have the full picture to make their own personal decision on what risks people want to take. And thus, when there is this heightened awareness, they can get more involved legislatively.
If there were such a thing as having a truly complete and objective assessment, and if such an assessment could be applied equally to all children and all people, then maybe we would be in a position to have a law that was clear and had a bright red line and applied to everybody. But there clearly is not, for example, just one profound hole in the whole works here. There is no way at this point to know what the true or full scope of death and disability caused by vaccines is, because we know from mainstream sources that the majority of those cases are probably not ever even reported. We don't know how vaccines are going to affect any given individual, any given vaccine, or any given combination of vaccines. We don't even have good research on combinations of vaccines over time for kids generally, let alone further information that would give us insight into the potential reactions for any given child, because every child is different and every child's going to respond differently, and some children sadly are going to die or be permanently disabled, and maybe not the first vaccine, maybe the third one or maybe the fifth one. You know, do we just keep on paying that cost as individuals, as families, as a society, because nobody is either capable or is bothering to do the research that needs to be done to figure out who is susceptible and who is not? I mean, that assumes that vaccines are otherwise effective and necessary, which is a whole separate question subject to debate. So there are just so many holes in all of this, and really what it comes down to, that as a broadly practical matter, and I think blatantly so, in a factual sense, the government is not in a position to be able to make that assessment and impose it, in a paternalistic way on the rest of us. So, you know, if people in certain positions of society or government or what have you have their opinion, that's fine. Then you go do what you think it is, but you know what? I've got a lot of valid information that says something different, and I want to do something different. And it is just so bizarre to me at this point in my own stage of research and insight on this issue that government would take it upon itself to make these kinds of decisions for us. But we're in a place where government has done that, so our job is to educate the government. And one of the ways you get the government to hear you is having clear and concise law and facts, in the case with the Colorado draft exemption forms, but then to the greatest extent possible, numbers behind you. So, you know, there is a grassroots initiative here that needs to happen with regard to each and every specific issue, such as, in this case, the Colorado draft exemption forms, but also with the larger vaccine controversy generally. And, of course, there's no shortage of, at this point in time, in this day and age, of Facebook groups and Yahoo groups and Google groups and the like, more websites popping up all the time with information. So there's no shortage of places to connect with people and places to go for information, but we're not where we need to be yet. So the next stage means bringing this increasingly to the mainstream. So going back to your earlier suggestions, yeah, like writing to your local newspaper and so forth. And what are some other ways that people might explore?
Right. So we have to learn how to be heard in the out there on the social networks and in our local community, and even do little talks or get together with people who are like-minded who have these concerns. And I'm sure that people who have families who have already been affected have become more outspoken, as if that has they've been touched by it and now it's their mission. I wanted to let people know before the end of the show about your ebook again so that they can study up on the law and learn some basics before they take any action, so that they know what they're, you know, have some facts behind them. And so a little bit about your ebook, maybe you can give us a couple of sentences about what they're going to learn by getting your ebook.
Sure. As with the larger vaccine controversy generally, there's this kind of a minimum body of information that you need to be able to make an informed choice about vaccines, about whether you want to delay or postpone or forego vaccines altogether, as sort of a conceptual issue. Because once you reach a place in your learning curve that you want to do something or look at doing something other than the status quo, do all the recommended or required vaccines, then the question is, well, what are your legal options? And I have found that in the arena of vaccine exemptions and vaccine exemption and waiver law, that oftentimes it is a complicated issue. And in order for people to make informed decisions about vaccine exemptions and waivers, there is a body of information concerning how the law works generally, but more importantly, the specific pieces of it, how they relate to individuals in any of a number of different contexts where the question about how to avoid vaccines comes up. And so the ebook was written with the intent of giving people that body of information that they need to be able to make informed decisions with regard to the exercise of vaccine exemptions and waivers. And what that decision is going to vary from person to person and situation to situation. But it includes addressing questions such as, when do you need an attorney and why? Many people, probably most of the time, people don't need an attorney. But there are many people who have done things on their own, gotten rejected, and come to me at that point. And it can be very difficult to fix something after the fact. You know, somebody, in effect, many times in that situation, you're in a position of needing to say or wanting to say, oops, never mind what I said before. Now this is what I really meant to say then. And that's, you know, you can't unring a bell, as the saying goes. So that can be a difficult situation. So as with any important legal issue, if it's really important, it's worth investing some time, and in some cases even some money, to get it right the first time.
Right.
You could spend a lot of money asking an attorney to bail you out of something you didn't do right the first time, and attorneys make a lot of money doing that. You spend a lot less money if you buy the ebook or if you do a, you know, one-time consultation just to make sure you have all your ducks in a row and that sort of thing. Again, that's not something that everybody needs to do every time they exercise an exemption. But with the information in this book, you know, you'll get some clarification about how the law works, where the boundaries are, what your rights are in the facts in your case or your situation.
Right. So it's like a little mini course to get you started. And then I also, before we end, I wanted to let people know again that Mary Aspinwall, homeopath, will be talking tonight on the Natural News Network on their talk hour, 6 p.m. Pacific time, 9 p.m. Eastern time. And it's going to be very exciting to learn what she has to say. There is an article on Natural News called Homeopathic Solutions on the next Natural News Talk Hour. And I assume she's going to give some basics. And then she might even talk about her new book coming out having to do with birth and birthing remedies, dealing with infertility and other kinds of female problems, which is a big issue. And it's great to know that there are homeopathic remedies to help women through these life cycle events that are safe and effective, gentle acting, and will not interfere with any other kind of health care that they are taking. So I do recommend people listen to that one tonight. And if there is not anything else that we have, we should just tell people that next Thursday is the first Thursday of the month. Is that correct? And we're going to have our special guest?
Yes, we'll have Greg Glazer back, as we've been having the first Thursday of the month for a while now. And that is always a wonderful show. Greg brings unique expertise and insight into related issues here. In particular, we've tried to focus on and branched out from questions about rights during declared emergencies or declaration of martial law and so forth. You know, what are our rights and to what extent are they clear or unclear and so forth. So we've had some wonderful conversations about that in the past, and we'll be delving more into that and, of course, look forward to that as always. Debbie, let me throw in one other quick thing here that I had meant to mention earlier and forgot about. I will be in Washington, D.C. this weekend, this Saturday, July 30th, with Kevin Muhammad, who is an author of two or three, I think, at least, vaccine books, maybe more. He's been researching and writing on this issue for many years, and I'm pleased and honored to say that I'll be co-presenting with him at the Anacostia Neighborhood Library on Good Hope Road Southeast. I would say for folks, I don't think I have information on this posted on my site at this point, but if you Google Kevin Muhammad, M-U-H-A-M-M-A-D, and vaccine or vaccination, I'm sure you'll bring up his website, and I'm sure he's got information about that there, although people are also welcome to contact me. My contact information is on the vaccinerights.com website. So I hope I'll see some folks there. I'm looking forward to that.
Okay. Well, I think that's it. We've covered the whole ground of that, and we're going to talk next time about the broader issues of constitutional law with Greg Glazer. And I want to thank you again, Alan. We'll see you the next week. Bye-bye, everyone.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate. Your love be your girl. What's life?
Your truth be a girl, one by one.